Hi, this is Ruth McCauley with news from the Decatur area for Thursday, December 10th. We begin with an article on the front page written by Allison Petty. Again, this is the Decatur Herald and Review we're going to start with, and the headline reads, Library Working Toward Terms of City Deal. The Decatur Public Library Board inched closer Wednesday to an agreement that would sell its building at 130 North Franklin Street to the City of Decatur. During a two-hour work session, board members reviewed a spectrum of topics to develop the basis for a lease agreement. Subjects ranged from utility costs and library space to building security and maintenance responsibilities. No formal action was taken. Library attorney Chris Sidula, I'm sure I've got that wrong, Sidula, Siudyla, will use the discussion as basis for developing the draft agreement, which the board is slated to consider December 17th. The clock is ticking. Several board members expressed a desire to resume exploring other options if the Decatur City Council does not make a decision by February. We have to move this along at a pretty rapid pace, said John Phillips, the board's president. Not that it's anybody's fault, but it's been 2 years that we've been working on this, and it's time to get it done. The board's actions come after an initial offer by the city last month to buy the library building for $10. The city proposed a 20-year lease with the library, with rent starting at $432,000 and increasing 5% every 5 years. In exchange, the city would provide for, quote, the repair, maintenance, capital improvements, and safeguarding, end quote, of the facilities. The city started its own negotiations after council members failed to support a long-brewing proposal for the Decatur Public Building Commission to buy the building. Library board members agreed Wednesday to use the former agreement with the Building Commission as a starting point to draft an agreement with the city. The deal would have kept the library's rent flat at $615,000 a year for 20 years and would include utilities. Macon County offices would have moved into the building's unused space on its second floor and in its annex. Drawing on the earlier proposal, library board members said Wednesday that they wanted to include utilities in the cost of rent paid to the city, asking for $615,000 rate that could increase 2.5% every 5 years. The term of the lease proposed would be 20 years, with several possible 5-year extensions. The library square footage and location within the building would change only with mutual consent. The discussion included questions about what kind of protections the library should attempt to build into its agreement, highlighting the fact that relations between the city and library have sometimes been complicated. The library is not a department of the city, and the city does not manage the library's expenses. However, the City Council does set the library's property tax levy, which provides the bulk of its revenue. Also, the city charges the library for some administrative functions. Board members wondered if there was a way to ensure that the City Council would set the library's tax levy at a level to cover potentially escalating lease or administrative costs. Greg Ziantara, the city's director of finance and a library board member, said he thought it was unlikely that the council would approve such a provision. He said he has noticed what appears to be a barrier between the city and library since he came to the city in 2012, one that needed to be broken. He repeated an earlier characterization of the library and the city as family. This is the City of Decatur's library. This is my library, Ziantara said. for me to not want to protect it as a citizen, as a board member, as a city employee is foreign language to me. During public comments, Katie Gross, head of the library's children's division, urged the board to be cautious in giving up control. She told Zientara that the library has often been treated as a bothersome stepchild in its familiar relationship with the city. Gross said that she would like to see a period of the two bodies getting along before adding another dimension to their relationship. The library can't always give mutual consent because they don't have the same amount of power, she said. If the city is controlling our space, then there is a very, very unequal power arrangement. Our next article comes from Springfield and was written by Tony Reed, who's an H&R staff writer. Ameren gains gas electricity delivery rate hikes. State regulators granted electric and natural gas delivery rate hikes to Ameren, Illinois on Wednesday that are likely to add at least $4 a month to the typical Decatur area customer's utility bill starting in January. Because of zone distribution costs, those increases could be significantly higher in other areas of central Illinois. Ameren described the price increases as varying from $2 to $6 a month for a residential gas bill and $2 to $7 a month for a residential electric bill. Announcing it had approved the rate increases, the Illinois Commerce Commission said the power bill hike is worth $106 million to the utility in 2016, pushing up electric delivery rates by 11.44%. That works out at a rate of return for Ameren shareholders of 9.14%. The ICC said Ameren had originally asked for a hike worth $110 million, but that was reduced by the regulators, who reduced spending in areas ranging from working capital to employee recognition expense. The natural gas delivery rate increase will be worth $45 million, a 12.44% rise over 2015 delivery rates. That worked out as a return for Ameren shareholders' investment of 9.6%. In a statement, the ICC said the gas increase had been cut down from Ameren's original request, valued at $55 million. But recent documents issued by the company said it was seeking just what it got, $45 million. The Citizens Utility Board public watchdog group said in any case the utility was getting more than it needed or deserved for both gas and electric service. And CUB, that's the Citizen Utility Board, CUB, will be filing petitions for rehearings on both hikes before the ICC. For central and southern Illinois consumers, receiving news like this is akin to receiving a big lump of coal this holiday season, said David Collada, CUB executive director. But Ameren insists the increases are fair, while delivering a solid deal for consumers. Under Illinois law, the utility is spending heavily to upgrade its electricity and natural gas infrastructure. The deal with the state is that it gets a faster turnaround on delivery rate hike requests in return for giving families and businesses more sophisticated and reliable service. Job creation goals tied to the upgrade work are also part of the agreement. Ameren, Illinois, points to a 17% improvement already achieved in electric service reliability since system modernization began in 2012. And when the lights do go out, they are now coming back on, an average of 18% faster than in previous years. On the gas side, pipes are being upgraded that have been in place since the 1950s and 60s. All this improvement work has created jobs for 550 employees and more than 1,500 contract workers in the state. By all measures, the electric and natural gas modernization plans are working for our customers and Illinois, said Craig Nelson, Senior Vice President of Regulatory and Financial Services for Ameren Illinois. Reliability is up, outages are down, and good-paying jobs are being created at a time when our state sorely needs them, he said. Ameren Illinois spokeswoman Marcelin Love said natural gas costs will be mitigated by sharply lower costs for the price of the fuel itself, which makes up the largest portion of customer bills. That cost of the gas, passed on without markup, is down 20% from last winter. Ameren said it offers budget billing to help level out utility payments, as well as various energy-efficient programs to cut energy costs. For more information about those programs, call 1-800-755-5000. Our next article was written by Teresa Churchill, who's a senior writer for the Decatur Herald and Review. Firefighters, law officers, battle for Salvation Army. Will this be the year Decatur Police and Macon County Sheriff's deputies turn the tables on city and county firefighters and win the annual Guns and Hoses kettle campaign by raising more money for the Salvation Army? Sheriff's Lieutenant Jonathan Butt said he likes their chances now that deputies will cover the coveted grocery entrance of Walmart at 224 North Prospect Drive, while for the second consecutive year, police will ring bells at both Walmart entrances at 4625 East Maryland Street. That leaves firefighters on either side of sheriff's deputies, with city firefighters at Sam's Club and rural fire protection districts at Walmart's south door. We rotate doors at the North Walmart every year, Butt said. This weekend, we are in position to divide and conquer. Decatur Detective Scott Rosenberry added that he's keeping his fingers crossed. It'd be nice to have some bragging rights, he said, but because we're all trying to raise money for a Salvation Army, I'm okay with whoever wins. That was about as bad as the trash talk got as law enforcement and firefighters prepare for their fifth annual bell ringing contest Friday and Saturday. This will be the third consecutive year all four groups joined in competition since sheriff's deputies and rural firefighters started the contest in 2011. So far, firefighters have raised more money each year, but the number everyone really pays attention to is the grand total raised, which amounted to $15,017 last year. We truly appreciate the help we receive from these fine men and women, said Major Wes Stahlberg of the Decatur Salvation Army. It's always a big weekend for us. City firefighter Josh Jackson said he is pleased how many of his colleagues are signing up for shifts at the Red Kettle this weekend. Guys from the same firehouse try to work together, he said. They have a good time with it. Keith Hackle, chief of the Warrensburg Fire Protection District, said even firefighters from outside Macon County, including Cerro Gordo, Latham, and Wapella, like to get in on the action. I wish we could get more businesses and organizations to get out and do what the police and firefighters are doing, Hackle said. It's all for a good cause. Here's another good news seasonal story. This one written by Valerie Wells, an H&R staff writer. Awards cap another record WSOY Community Food Drive. A lunch between three friends 14 years ago to discuss a way to give back to the community has grown into a giant food drive that this year netted a record $1.3 million that filled 26 semi-trucks. We just had a good year in business and felt we should do something to give back, said Brian Byers of Newhoff Media, one of those three friends. The others were Kevin Breheny of J.L. Hubbard Insurance and Bonds and John Skeffington of Skeff Distributing. The first year, the WSOY Community Food Drive collected 35,000 pounds of food. Now, hundreds of volunteers, 63 schools, and business sponsors pull together to fill food pantry shelves, an effort that Beyer said is as large or larger than any in the country. It starts with mom and dad and also with schools, Breheny said. When he was a child in school, his class wrapped packs of cigarettes in Christmas paper to give to residents at a nearby nursing home, he said, which got a big laugh. That's what we did then, he said, laughing too. His first food drive was at Quincy College, but he remembered a radio station in Chicago with a goal to fill up one semi-truck with donated food. I never dreamed we'd see 26 semi-trucks filled in one day in this community, he said. At St. Patrick Catholic Church on Wednesday, the checks were handed out with $140,000 each to Catholic Charities and the Salvation Army, $75,000 to Northeast Community Fund and Good Samaritan Inn, $50,000 to Reasonable Service, which is new to the recipient list, $25,000 to the Judy Mason Thanksgiving Basket Project, which provides food boxes for 4,000 families, which provided food boxes to 4,000 families this year, and $2,500 micro grants to God's Shelter of Love, Amelka Food Pantry, Interchurch Council of Blue Mound, Booty and Stonington. Oops, I'm sorry, that's the other community. Interchurch Council of Blue Mound, Booty, and Stonington, and Mount Zion United Methodist Food Pantry. This will mean a great deal to the thousands of people we serve, said Major Wesley Dahlberg of the Salvation Army. It's unfortunate that we're not going out of business anytime soon. We'll be able to reach out to people in need, the underemployed, the unemployed, and the ones just down on their luck. Speaking as someone who came here from somewhere else, I've never seen 1.3 million pounds of food collected in 12 hours in a city of any size. It's incredible. Reasonable Services' Quinn Mewks said their pantry has had to close for periods because they ran out of food to give away. This check will allow a regular schedule to resume. The school winner was once again St. Patrick's School, which has won almost every year. The school received a check for $2,500. Byers said the prizes for the school competition and the plaques for the other awards are all paid for by sponsors so that all the food and cash donations can go directly to charitable organizations. The other schools recognized on Wednesday were St. Teresa High School, second place, Holy Family School, third place, Mount Zion High School, fourth place, and Warrensburg Latham High School, fifth place. The Jeffrey Newhoff Spirit Award, given to recognize a volunteer who provided exemplary service to the food drive, went to Kenny Burns, who, Beyer said, has never said no when he is asked to help. Business sponsors recognized include the City Community Fund of Macon County, Hickory Point Bank, and Archer Daniels Midland Company. The business community in this city is as generous as any in this country, Beyer said. Sponsors include Team Soy, Soy Capital Bank and J.L. Hubbard, Ticket and Trips, Jones and Thomas, J.T. Net, Decatur Back and Neck Center, Kroger, WAND-TV, The Herald and Review, First Christian Church, Skeff Distributing, Dale's Southlake Pharmacy, and Coley's Corner Drugs, ADM, Dyna Graphics Wood Printing, United Way, and the Howard G. Buffett Foundation for a $100,000 matching grant. Okay, this from Huey Freeman, who was our crime and courts reporter. Fugitive falls through ceiling as police search house. A fugitive wanted in connection with prior incidents of domestic battery and theft was arrested after he crashed through a ceiling as an officer searched for him in a house on the city's northwest side. An associate who changed clothes with the fugitive to try to help him elude police was arrested on a charge of obstructing justice. About 12:50 p.m. Tuesday, Special Deputy U.S. Marshal Lauren Sturdivant spotted David Titsworth, 30, as he stood in the driveway of a house in the 1600 block of West Highland Court. "I saw Titsworth, who was wearing a red t-shirt and black pants, enter the residence," said a probable cause affidavit by Sturdivant. A short time later, Timothy C. Holgarth exited the same residence, and he was wearing the same clothes that Titsworth was wearing before entering the residence. Holgarth, 31, approached Sturdivant and told him that if he was looking for Titsworth, he could be found on the city's east side. After other officers arrived on the scene, Holgarth granted permission to search his residence for Titsworth. As an officer searched the house, Sturdivant spoke with Holgarth outside when he told him that he knew that he and Titsworth had exchanged clothes to try to trick him. Holgarth became irate and ordered the officer out of his residence. Sturdivant then placed Holgarth under arrest for obstructing justice. Holgarth offered to get Titsworth to surrender in exchange for his freedom. Sturdivant declined the offer. While waiting for more assistance to arrive, Titsworth, who was hiding in the attic of the residence, fell through the ceiling, Sturdivant wrote in his statement. Titsworth eventually exited the residence and surrendered. Titsworth, who is being held in jail without bond, is due in court for his arraignment by Wednesday. Holgarth, whose bond was set at $15,000, will be arraigned by Wednesday if he remains in custody. Our next article was written by Ryan Voiles, who is a Decatur Herald and Review staff writer. Local law agencies head toward e-citations. Local law enforcement are set to move forward on an electronic citation system to streamline the process of information to the courts. The plan, which the Macon County Board will vote on tonight at its monthly meeting, would allow officers to write e-citations from their vehicles, which will then be sent electronically to the circuit clerk, the state, and other necessary officers and agencies. The Macon County Sheriff's Office, Decatur Police Department, and Mount Zion Police Department are among the participating agencies. The Circuit Clerk's Office will pay for the originating licensing fee of $39,000 out of its e-citation fund. Sheriff's Lieutenant Jonathan Butts said the benefit to officers would include freeing more time and lessening busy work from the current process of handwriting all citations on paper and then handing them in. It will be more efficient and less time-consuming and will allow the officers to transfer the information from the vehicle, he said. To pay for the service, Butts said the circuit clerk's office and other local law enforcement agencies have collected a $5 fee on citations. That fee was split in two, with clerk's office keeping $3 and the issuing agency keeping the other two. The plan was passed unanimously at the County Board's Finance Committee. Also on the agenda is to continue the relationship between Macon and Peoria counties in hosting the former's juvenile criminal suspects. Per the agreement, Peoria County would have 5 reserved bed spaces at its juvenile detention center to house juveniles from Macon County. Macon County will pay $224,706 to cover the cost of the 5 guaranteed beds and for transportation costs for one officer. Each individual bed is rented at a space of $123.12 per day. Macon County would also have to pay $18 an hour for detainee transports that would require a second officer. The plan was approved by the Macon County Finance Board. If approved by the full board, it would go into effect January 1st. And this quick article about a single vehicle fatality. A 29-year-old Blue Mound man was pronounced dead at the scene of an accident that occurred on Decatur's west edge about 3:30 a.m. on Wednesday. Police officers located a 1998 Chevy Tahoe on its top in the ditch just west of a driveway in the 3600 block of West Center Street, according to the Decatur Police Department. A white male driver, the only occupant of the vehicle, had been ejected. He was not wearing a seatbelt. The victim's name is being withheld pending notification of family members. It was a single vehicle accident, Macon County Coroner E. Michael Day said. Preliminary investigation by the Decatur Police Fatal Accident Investigation Team showed that the driver was traveling west on Center Street, crossed the center line, and left the roadway. The SUV struck a berm and a power pole, flipped over, and came to rest on its top. And quickly, North Ellen Street will be closed from Colonial Mall to Cushing Avenue from 8 a.m. until about 5 p.m. today for sewer repair work, with the weather permitting. So maybe many of you have already discovered that if you've been out and about today. But for some of you, this may be a cautionary article to make note of. Okay, it's time to take a quick break. Then I'll be back for the second half hour of news from the Decatur area for December 10th.